Disc 2.
Her special gift was arson, and it was legend that she could intuit the cause of a fire simply by hearing a description of the scene. I worked on two pairs of latex gloves as McGovern scanned the horizon, her eyes staying a long time on the blackened pit with its shell of standing granite. I followed her gaze to scorched stables, and in my mind heard screams and panicked hooves battering stalls. For an instant, my throat constricted. I had seen the raw, clawed hands of people buried alive, and the defense injuries of victims who struggled with their killers. I knew about life fighting not to die, and I could not bear the vivid footage playing in my mind. "Goddamn reporters!" McGovern stared up at a small helicopter flying low overhead. It was a white Schweitzer with no identification or mounted cameras I could see. McGovern stepped forward and boldly pointed out every member of the media within 5 miles. "That van there," she let me know. "Radio, some local yokel FM dial with a celebrity talent named Jezebel, who tells moving stories about life and her crippled son and his three-legged dog named Sport. And another radio over there. And that Ford Escort over that way is some fucking son-of-a-bitch newspaper. Probably some tabloid out of D.C. Then we got the Post." She pointed at a Honda. "So look out for her. She's the brunette with legs. Can you imagine wearing a skirt out here? Probably thinks the guys will talk to her. But they know better, unlike the Phoebes." She backed up and grabbed a handful of latex gloves from inside the super truck. I dug my hands deeper into the pockets of my BDUs. I'd gotten used to McGovern's diatribes about the biased, mendacious media, and I barely listened. "And this is just the start," she went on. "These media maggots will be crawling all over the place because I already know about this one here. It doesn't take a Boy Scout to guess how this place burned and all those poor horses got killed." "You seem more cheerful than usual," I dryly said. "I'm not cheerful in the least." She propped her foot on the shiny tailgate of the super truck as an old station wagon pulled up. Pepper, the arson dog, was a handsome black Labrador retriever. He wore an ATF badge on his collar and was no doubt comfortably curled in the warm front seat, going nowhere until we were ready for him. "What can I do to help?" I said to her. "Besides staying out of the way until you need me." She was staring off. "If I were you, I'd hang out with Pepper or in the truck. Both are heated." McGovern had worked with me before and knew if I was needed to dive into a river or sift through fire or bombing debris, I was not above the task. She knew I could hold a shovel and did not sit around. I resented her comments and felt she was somehow picking on me. I turned to address her again and found her standing very still, like a bird dog pointing. She had an incredulous expression on her face as she remained fixed to some spot on the horizon. "Holy Jesus," she muttered. I followed her stare to a lone black foal, maybe 100 yards due east of us, just beyond the smoky ruins of the stables. The magnificent animal looked carved from ebony from where we stood, and I could make out twitching muscles and tail as he seemed to return our attention. "The stables," McGovern said in awe. "How the hell did he get away?" She got on her portable radio. "Tian to Jennifer," she said. "Go ahead. Take a look maybe beyond the stables. See what I do? 10-4. Got the four-legged subject in sight. Make sure the locals know. We need to find out if subject is a survivor from here or a runaway from somewhere else. You got it." McGovern strode off, a shovel over her shoulder. I watched her move into the stinking pit and pick a spot near what appeared to have once been the wide front door, cold water up to her knees. Far off, the aloof black horse wavered as if made of fire. I slogged ahead in soggy boots, my fingers getting increasingly uncooperative. It was only a matter of time before I would need a toilet, which typically would be a tree, a mound, an acre somewhere in what was sworn to be a blind with no men within a mile. I did not enter the remaining stone shell at first, but walked slowly around it from the outside perimeter. The caving in of remaining structures was an obvious and extreme danger at scenes of mass destruction, and although the two-story walls looked sturdy enough, it would have suited me better had they been pulled down by a crane and trucked away. I continued my scan in the bright, cool wind, my heart sinking as I wondered where to begin. My shoulders ached from my aluminum case, and just the thought of dragging a rake through waterlogged debris sent a pain into my back. I was certain McGovern was watching to see how long I would last. Through gaping wounds of windows and doors, I could see the sooty pit coiling with thousands of flat steel whiskey barrel hoops that drifted in black water. I imagined reserve bourbon exploding from burning white oak kegs and pouring through the door in a river of fire downhill to the stables that had housed Kenneth Sparks' precious horses. While investigators began the task of determining where the fire had started, and hopefully its cause, I stepped through puddles and climbed atop anything that looked sturdy enough to bear my weight. Nails were everywhere, and with a Buckman tool that had been a gift from Lucy, I pulled one of them out of my left boot. I stopped inside the perfect stone rectangle of a doorway in the front of the former mansion. For minutes I stood and looked. Unlike many investigators, I did not take photographs with every inch I moved closer into a crime scene. I had learned to bide my time and let my eyes go first. As I quietly scanned around me, I was struck by many things. The front of the house, unsurprisingly, would have afforded the most spectacular view. From upper stories no longer there, one should have seen trees and gentle hills, and the various activities of the horses that the owner bought, traded, bred, and sold. It was believed that Kenneth Sparks had been home the night of the fire on June 7th, and I remembered that the weather had been clear and a little warmer, with a light wind and full moon. I surveyed the empty shell of what must have been a mansion, looking at soggy couch parts, metal, glass, the melted guts of televisions and appliances. There were hundreds of partially burned books and paintings, mattresses and furniture. All had fallen from upper stories and settled into soupy layers in the basement. As I imagined Sparks in the evening when the fire alarm went off, I imagined him in the living room with its view, or in the kitchen, perhaps cooking. Yet the more I explored where he might have been, the less I understood why he had not escaped, unless he were incapacitated by alcohol or drugs, or had tried to put out the fire until carbon monoxide had overcome him. Lucy and comrades were on the other side of the pit, prying open an electrical box that heat and water had caused to rust instantly. "Good luck," McGovern's voice carried as she waded closer to them. "That's not going to be what started this one." She kept talking as she slung a blackened frame of an ironing board to one side. The iron and what was left of its cord followed. She kicked more barrel hoops out of the way as if she were mad at whoever had caused this mess. "You notice the windows?" she went on to them. "The broken glass is on the inside. Makes you think someone broke in?" "Not necessarily." It was Lucy who answered as she squatted to look. "You get thermal impact to the inside of the glass, and it heats up and expands more and faster than the exterior, causing uneven stress and heat cracks, which are distinctively different from mechanical breakage." She handed a jagged piece of broken glass to McGovern, her supervisor. "Smoke goes out of the house," Lucy went on, "and the atmosphere comes in. Equalization of pressure. It doesn't mean someone broke in." "You get a B+, McGovern said to her. "No way. I get an A." Several of the agents laughed. "But I have to agree with Lucy," one of them said. "So far, I'm not seeing any sign that someone broke in." Their team leader continued turning our disaster site into a classroom for her soon-to-be certificated fire investigators, or CFIs. "Remember we talked about smoke coming through brick?" she continued, pointing up to areas of stone along the roofline that looked as if they had been scrubbed with steel brushes. "Or is that erosion from blasts of water?" "No, the mortar's partially eaten away. That's from smoke." "That's right. From smoke pushing through the joints. McGovern was matter-of-fact. Fire establishes its own vent paths. And low around the walls here, here, and here, she pointed, the stone is burned clean of all incomplete combustion or soot. We've got melted glass and melted copper pipes. It started low, on the first floor, Lucy said. The main living area. Looks like that to me. And flames went up as high as 10 feet to engage the second floor and roof, which would take a pretty decent fuel load. Accelerants. But forget finding a pore pattern in this shit. Don't forget anything, McGovern told her team. And we don't know if an accelerant was necessary because we don't know what kind of fuel load was on that floor. They were splashing and working as they talked, and all around was the constant sound of dripping water and rumbling of the pumps. I got interested in box springs caught in my rake and squatted to pull out rocks and charred wood with my hands. One always had to consider that a fire victim might have died in bed, and I peered up at what once had been the upper floors. I continued excavating, producing nothing remotely human, only the sodden, sour trash of all that had been ruined in Kenneth Sparks' fine estate. Some of his former possessions still smoldered on tops of piles that were not submerged, but most of what I raked was cold and permeated with the nauseating smell of scorched bourbon. Our sifting went on throughout the morning, and as I moved from one square of muck to the next, I did what I knew how to do best. I groped and probed with my hands, and when I felt a shape that worried me, I took off my heavy fire gloves and felt some more with fingers barely sheathed by latex. McGovern's troops were scattered and lost in their own hunches, and at almost noon she waded back to me. "You holding up?" she asked. "Still standing." "Not bad for an armchair detective," she smiled. "I'll take that as a compliment." "You see how even everything is?" she pointed a sooty, gloved finger. "High-temperature fire, constant from one corner of the house to the other. Flames so hot and high they burned up the upper two floors and pretty near everything in them. We're not talking some electrical arc here, not some curling iron left on or grease that caught fire. Something big and smart's behind this." I had noticed over the years that people who battled fire spoke of it as if it were alive and possessed a will and personality of its own. McGovern began working by my side, and what she couldn't sling out of the way, she piled into a wheelbarrow. I polished what turned out to be a stone that could have passed for a finger bone, and she pointed the wooden butt of her rake up at an empty, overcast sky. "The top level's going to be the last one to fall," she told me. "In other words, debris from the roof and second floor should be on top down here. So I'm assuming that's what we're rooting around in right now." She stabbed the rake at a twisted steel I-beam that once had supported the roof. "Yes, sir," she went on. "That's why there's all this insulation and slate everywhere." This went on and on, with no one taking breaks that were longer than 15 minutes. The local fire station kept us supplied in coffee, sodas, and sandwiches, and had set up quartz lights, so we could see as we worked in our wet hole. At each end, a Prosser pump sucked water through its hose and disgorged it outside granite walls, and after thousands of gallons were gone, our conditions did not seem much better. It was hours before the level dipped perceptibly. At 2:30, I could stand it no longer and went outside again. I scanned for the most inconspicuous spot, which was beneath the sweeping boughs of a large fir tree near the smoking stables. My hands and feet were numb, but beneath heavy protective clothing I was sweating as I squatted and kept a nervous watch for anyone who might wander this way. Then I steeled myself to walk past every charred stall. The stench of death pushed itself up into my nostrils and seemed to cling to spaces inside my skull. Horses were pitifully piled on top of each other, their legs pugilistically drawn, and skin split from the swelling and shrinking of cooking flesh. Mares, stallions, and geldings were burned down to bone, with smoke still drifting from carcasses charred like wood. I hoped they had succumbed to carbon monoxide poisoning before flames had touched them. I counted 19 bodies, including 2 yearlings and a foal. The miasma of burned horsehair and death was choking and enveloped me like a heavy cloak as I headed across grass back to the mansion's shell. On the horizon, the sole survivor was watching me again, standing very still, alone and mournful. McGovern was still sloshing and shoveling and pitching trash out of her way, and I could tell she was getting tired, and I was perversely pleased by that. It was getting late in the day. The sky had gotten darker, and the wind had a sharper edge. "The foal is still there," I said to her. "Wish he could talk." She straightened up and massaged the small of her back. "He's running loose for a reason," I said. "It doesn't make sense to think he got out on his own. I hope someone plans to take care of him." "We're working on it." "Couldn't one of the neighbors help?" I would not stop, because the horse was really getting to me. She gave me a long look and pointed straight up. "Master bedroom and bath were right up there," she announced as she lifted a broken square of white marble out of the filthy water. "Brass fixtures, a marble floor, the jets from a jacuzzi. The frame of a skylight, which, by the way, was open at the time of the fire. If you reach down 6 inches to your left, you'll run right into what's left of the tub." The water level continued to lower as pumps sucked and formed small rivers over grass. Nearby agents were pulling out antique oak flooring that was deeply charred on top, with very little unburned wood left. This went on, and added to mounting evidence that the origin of the fire was the second floor in the area of the master suite, where we recovered brass pulls from cabinets and mahogany furniture, and hundreds of coat hangers. We dug through burnt cedar and remnants of men's shoes and clothing from the master closet. By 5 o'clock, the water had dropped another foot, revealing a ruined landscape that looked like a burned landfill, with scorched hulls of appliances and the carcasses of couches. McGovern and I were still excavating in the area of the master bath, fishing out prescription bottles of pills and shampoos and body lotions, when I finally discovered the first shattered edge of death. I carefully wiped soot from a jagged slab of glass. "I think we've got something," I said, and my voice seemed swallowed by dripping water and the sucking of pumps. McGovern shone her flashlight on what I was doing and went still. "Oh, Jesus," she said. Milky dead eyes gleamed at us through watery broken glass. A window, maybe a glass shower door, fell on top of the body, preserving at least some of it from being burned to the bone, I said. I moved more broken glass aside, and McGovern was momentarily stunned as she stared at a grotesque body that I instantly knew was not Kenneth Sparks. The upper part of the face was pressed flat beneath thick, cracked glass, and the eyes were a dull bluish-gray because their original color had been cooked out of them. They peered up at us from the burned bone of the brow. Strands of long blonde hair had gotten free and eerily flowed as dirty water seeped, and there was no nose or mouth, only chalky, calcined bone and teeth that had been burned until there was nothing organic left in them. The neck was partially intact, the torso covered with more broken glass and melted into cooked flesh was a dark fabric that had been a blouse or shirt. I could still make out the weave. Buttocks and pelvis were also spared beneath glass. The victim had been wearing jeans. The legs were burned down to bone, but leather boots had protected the feet. There were no lower arms or hands, and I could not find any trace of those bones. "Who the hell is this?" McGovern said, amazed. "Did he live with someone?" "I don't know," I said, scooping more water out of the way. "Can you tell if it's a female?" McGovern said as she leaned closer to look, her flashlight still pointed. I wouldn't want to swear to it in court until I can examine her more closely. But yes, I'm thinking female, I answered. I looked up at empty sky, imagining the bathroom the woman possibly had died in, and then got cameras out of my kit as cold water lapped around my feet. Pepper the arson dog and his handler had just filled the doorway, and Lucy and other agents were wading our way as word of our find hummed down the line. I thought of Sparks, and nothing here made sense, except that a woman had been inside his home the night of the fire. I feared his remains might be somewhere in here, too. Agents came nearer, and one of them brought me a body bag. I unfolded it and took more photographs. Flesh had cooked to glass and would have to be separated. This I would do in the morgue, and I instructed that any debris around the body would need to be sent in as well. I'm going to need some help, I said to everyone. Let's get a backboard and some sheets in here, and someone needs to call whatever local funeral home is responsible for body removals. We're going to need a van. Be careful, the glass is sharp. As she is, in situ. Face up, just like she is now, so we don't put too much stress on the body and tear the skin. That's good. Now open the bag more, as wide as we can get it. It ain't gonna fit. Maybe we could break off more of the glass around the edges here, McGovern suggested. Somebody got a hammer? No, let's just cover her as is. I issued more commands, for I was in charge now. Drape this over and around the edges to protect your hands. Everybody got their gloves on? Yeah. Those of you who aren't helping here, there may be another body, so let's keep looking. I was tense and irritable as I waited for two agents to return with a backboard and blue plasticized sheets to cover it. Okay, I said. We're going to lift. On the count of three. Water sloshed and splashed as four of us struggled for leverage and balance. It was awful groping for sure footing as we gripped slippery wet glass that was sharp enough to cut through leather. Here we go, I said. One, two, three, lift! We centered the body on the backboard. I covered it as best I could with the sheets and fastened it snugly with straps. Our steps were small and hesitant as we felt our way through water that no longer came over our boots. The Prosser pumps and generator were a constant humming throb that we scarcely noticed as we ferried our morbid cargo closer to the empty space that once had been a door. I smelled cooked flesh and death, and the acrid, rotting odor of fabric, food, furniture, and all that had burned in Kenneth Sparks' home. I was breathless and numb with stress and cold as I emerged into the pale light of the fast-retreating day. We lowered the body to the ground, and I kept watch over it as the rest of the team continued their excavation. I opened the sheets and took a close, long look at this pitifully disfigured human being, and got a flashlight and lens out of my aluminum case. Glass had melted around the head at the bridge of the nose, and bits of pinkish material and ash were snared in her hair. I used light and magnification to study areas of flesh that had been spared, and wondered if it was my imagination when I discovered hemorrhage in charred tissue in the left temporal area, about an inch from the eye. Lucy suddenly was by my side, and Wiser Funeral Home was pulling up in a shiny dark blue van. "Find something?" Lucy asked. "Don't know with certainty, but this looks like hemorrhage versus the drying you find with skin splitting." "Skin splitting from fire, you mean?" "Yes. Flesh cooks and expands, splitting the skin. Same thing that happens when you cook chicken in the oven." "You got it," I said. Damage to skin, muscle, and bone is easily mistaken for injuries caused by violence if one is not familiar with the artifacts of fire. Lucy squatted closer to me. She looked on. "Anything else turning up in there?" I asked her. "No other bodies, I hope." "Not so far," she said. "It will be dark soon, and all we can do is keep the scene secured until we can start again in the morning." I looked up as a man in a pinstripe suit climbed out of the funeral home van and worked on latex gloves. He loudly pulled the stretcher out from the back, and metal clacked as he unfolded the legs.
"You gonna get started tonight, Doc?"
he asked me, and I knew I'd seen him somewhere before. "Let's get her to Richmond, and I'll start in the morning," I said.
"Last time I saw you was the Moser shooting. That young girl they was fighting over still causing trouble round here."
"Oh, yes." I vaguely remembered, for there were so many shootings and so many people who caused trouble. "Thank you for your help," I said to him. We lifted the body by gripping the edges of the heavy vinyl pouch. We lowered the remains onto the stretcher and slid it into the back of the van. He slammed shut tailgate doors.
"I hope it's not Kenneth Sparks in there," he said.
"No identification yet," I told him. He sighed and slid into the driver's seat.
"Well, let me tell you something," he said, cranking the engine. "I don't care what anybody says. He was a good man."
I watched him drive away and could sense Lucy's eyes on me. She touched my arm. "You're exhausted," she said. "Why don't you spend the night and I'll fly you back in the morning? If we find anything else, we'll let you know right away. No point in your hanging around." I had very difficult work ahead, and the sensible thing to do was to head back to Richmond now. But in truth, I did not feel like walking inside my empty home. Benton would be at Hilton Head by now, and Lucy was staying in Warrenton. It was too late to call upon any of my friends, and I was too spent for polite conversation. It was one of those times when I could think of nothing that might soothe me. "Taeon's moved us to a better place, and I got an extra bed in my room, Aunt Kay," Lucy added with a smile as she pulled a car key out of her pocket. "So now I'm Aunt Kay again. As long as nobody's around." "I've got to get something to eat," I said. 3. We bought drive-through Whoppers and fries at a Burger King on Broadview, and it was dark out and very cool. Approaching headlights hurt my eyes, and no amount of Motrin would relieve the hot pain in my temples or the dread in my heart. Lucy had brought her own CDs and was playing one of them loudly as we glided through Warrenton in a rented black Ford LTD. "What's this you're listening to?" I asked, as a way of registering a complaint.
"Jim Brickman," she sweetly said.
"Not hardly," I said over flutes and drum.
"Sounds Native American to me. And maybe could we turn it down a bit?"
Instead, she turned it up.
"David Arkenstone, Spirit Wind.
Got to open your mind, Aunt Kay. This one right now is called Destiny."
Lucy drove like the wind, and my mind began to float.
"You're getting kooky on me," I said, as I imagined wolves and campfires in the night.
"His music's all about connectivity and finding your way and positive force," she went on, as the music got lively and added guitars. "Don't you think that fits?"
I couldn't help but laugh at her complicated explanation. Lucy had to know how everything worked and the reason why. The music, in truth, was soothing, and I felt a brightening and calm in frightening places in my mind.
"What do you think happened, Aunt Kay?" Lucy suddenly broke the spell. "I mean, in your heart of hearts."
"Right now, it's impossible to say,"
I answered her the way I would anybody else. "And we shouldn't assume anything, including gender or who might have been staying in the house."
"Taeona is already thinking arson, and so am I," she matter-of-factly stated. "What's weird is Pepper didn't alert on anything in any areas where we thought he might."
"Like the master bathroom on the first floor?" I said.
"Nothing there. Poor Pepper worked like a dog and didn't get fed."
The Labrador Retriever had been food reward trained since his youth to detect hydrocarbon petroleum distillates such as kerosene, gasoline, lighter fluid, paint thinner, solvents, lamp oil. All were possible, if not common, choices for the arsonist who wanted to start a major fire with the drop of a match. When accelerants are poured at a scene, they pool and flow as their vapors burn. The liquid soaks into fabric or bedding or carpet. It seeps under furniture and between the cracks in flooring. It is not water-soluble or easy to wash away. So if Pepper had found nothing to excite his nose, chances were good that nothing was there. "What we got to do is find out exactly what was in the house so we can begin to calculate the fuel load," Lucy went on, as the music turned to violins and strings and drums got sadder. "Then we can begin to get a better idea about what and how much would have been needed to get something like that going." There was melted aluminum and glass, and tremendous burning of the body in the upper legs and lower arms, any areas that weren't spared by the glass door, I said. "That suggests to me the victim was down, possibly in the bathtub, when the fire reached her." "It would be bizarre to think a fire like this started in a marble bathroom," my niece said. "What about electrical? Any possibility of that?" I asked. "And our motel's red and yellow lighted sign floated above the highway, maybe a mile ahead. Look, the place had been electrically upgraded. When fire reached the wires and insulation was degraded by heat, the ground wires came in contact with each other. The circuit failed, the wires arced, and the circuit breakers tripped," she said. "That's exactly what I would expect to happen, whether the fire was set or not. It's hard to say. There's a lot left to look at, and of course the labs will do their thing. But whatever got it going fast. You can tell from some of the flooring. There's a sharp demarcation between really deep charring and the unburned wood, and that means hot and fast." I remembered wood near the body looking just as she had described. It was alligatored, or blistered black on top, versus slowly burned all the way through. "First floor again?" I asked, as my private suspicions about this case grew darker. "Probably. Plus, we know things happened fast anyway, based on when the alarm went off and what the firefighters found 17 minutes later." She was quiet for a moment, then went on. "The bathroom. The possible hemorrhage in tissue near her left eye. What? Maybe she was taking a bath or shower? She's overcome by carbon monoxide and falls and hits her head?" "It appears she was fully dressed when she died," I reminded her, "including boots. If the smoke alarm goes off while you're in the bath or shower, I doubt you'd take time to put on all that." Lucy turned the volume up even louder and adjusted the bass. Bells jingled with drums, and I oddly thought of incense and myrrh. I wanted to lie in the sun with Benton and sleep. I wanted the ocean to roll over my feet as I walked in the morning exploring the beach, and I remembered Kenneth Sparks as I had seen him last. I envisioned what was left of him turning up next. "This is called the Wolf Hunt," Lucy said, as she turned into a white brick shell food mart. "And maybe that's what we're on, huh? After the big bad wolf?" "No," I said as she parked. "I think we're looking for a dragon." She threw a Nike windbreaker over her gun and BDUs. "You didn't see me do this," she said as she opened her door. "Tian would kick my ass to the moon." "You've been around Marino too long," I said, for he rarely minded rules and was known to carry beer home in the trunk of his unmarked police car. Lucy went inside, and I doubted that she fooled anyone in her filthy boots and faded blue pants with so many pockets and the tenacious smell of fire. A keyboard and cowbell began a different rhythm on the CD as I waited in the car and longed for sleep. Lucy returned with a six-pack of Heineken, and we drove on as I drifted with flute and percussion until sudden images shocked me straight up in my seat. I envisioned bared, chalky teeth and dead eyes the grayish blue of boiled eggs. Hair strayed and floated like dirty corn silk in black water, and crazed, melted glass was an intricate, sparkling web around what was left of the body. "Are you all right?" Lucy sounded worried as she looked over at me. "I think I just fell asleep," I said. "I'm fine." Johnson's motel was just ahead of us on the other side of the highway. It was stone with a red and white tin awning, and a red and yellow lit-up sign out front promised it was open 24 hours a day and had air conditioning. The no part of the vacancy sign was dark, which boded well for those in need of a place to stay. We got out and a welcome mat announced, "Hello," outside the lobby. Lucy rang a bell. A big black cat came to the door, and then a big woman seemed to materialize from nowhere to let us in. "We should have a reservation for a room for two," Lucy said.
"Checkout's 11 in the morning," the woman stated as she went around to her side of the counter. "I can give you 15 down there at the end."
"We're ATF," Lucy said.
"Honey, I already figured out that one. The other lady was just in here. You're all paid up."
A sign posted above the door said no checks, but encouraged MasterCard and Visa, and I thought of McGovern and her resourceful ways.
"You need two keys?" the clerk asked us as she opened a drawer.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Here's you go, honey. And there's two nice beds in there. If I'm not around when you check out, just leave the keys on the counter."
"Glad you got security," Lucy drolly said.
"Sure do. Double locks on every door."
"How late does room service stay open?" Lucy played with her again.
"Until that Coke machine out front quits," the woman said with a wink.
She was at least 60, with dyed red hair and jowls, and a squat body that pushed against every inch of her brown polyester slacks and yellow sweater. It was obvious that she was fond of black and white cows. There were carvings and ceramic ones on shelves and tables and fastened to the wall. A small fish tank was populated with an odd assortment of tadpoles and minnows, and I couldn't help asking her about them.
"Homegrown," I said. She gave me a sheepish smile. "I catch 'em in the pond out back. One of them turned into a frog not long ago when it drowned. I didn't know frogs can't live underwater."
"I'm going to use the payphone," Lucy said, opening the screen door.
"And, by the way, what happened to Marino?"
"I think some of them went out to eat somewhere," I said.
She left with our Burger King bag, and I suspected she was calling Janet, and that our Whoppers would be cold by the time we got to them. As I leaned against the counter, I noticed the clerk's messy desk on the other side, and the local paper with its front page headline, "Media Mogul's Farm Destroyed by Fire." I recognized a subpoena among her clutter and posted notices of reward money for information about murders, accompanied by composite sketches of rapists, thieves, and killers. All the same, Fauquier was the typical quiet county where people got lulled into feeling safe.
"I hope you aren't working here all by yourself at night," I said to the clerk, because it was my irrepressible habit to give security tips, whether or not anyone wanted them.
"I've got Pickle," she affectionately referred to her fat black cat.
"That's an interesting name."
"You leave an open pickle jar around, she'll get into it. Dips her paw right in, ever since she was a kitten."
Pickle was sitting in a doorway leading into a room that I suspected was the clerk's private quarters. The cat's eyes were gold coins fixed on me as her fluffy tail twitched. She looked bored when the bell rang, and her owner unlocked the door for a man in a tank top who was holding a burned-out light bulb.
"Looks like it done it again, Helen."
He handed her the evidence. She went into a cabinet and brought out a box of light bulbs as I gave Lucy plenty of time to get off the payphone so I could use it. I glanced at my watch. Certain Benton should have made it to Hilton Head by now.
"Here you go, Big Jim."
She exchanged a new light bulb for bad.
"That's 60 watts.
She squinted at it.
"Uh-huh. You here a little longer?"
She sounded as if she hoped he would be.
"Hell if I know."
"Oh, dear," said Helen.
"So things still aren't too good."
"When have they ever been?"
He shook his head as he went out into the night.
"Fighting with his wife again," Helen the clerk commented to me as she shook her head, too. "Course, he's been here before, which is partly why they fight so much. Never knew there'd be so many people cheating on each other. Half the business here is from folks just 3 miles down the road.
And they can't fool you, I said.
Oh, no siree, Bob. But it's none of my business as long as they don't wreck the room.
You're not too far from the farm that burned, I then said. She got more animated.
I was working that night. You could see the flames shooting up like a volcano going off. She gestured broadly with her arms. Everyone staying here was out front watching and listening to the sirens. All those poor horses. I can't get over it.
Are you acquainted with Kenneth Sparks? I wondered out loud.
Can't say I've ever seen him in person.
What about a woman who might have been staying in his house? I asked.
You ever heard anything about that?
Only what people say.
Helen was looking at the door as if someone might appear any second.
For example, I prodded.
Well, I guess Mr. Sparks is quite the gentleman, you know, Helen said. Not that his ways are popular around here, but he's quite a figure. Likes them young and pretty.
She thought for a moment and gave me her eyes as moths flickered outside the window.
There are those who got upset when they'd see him around with the newest one, she said. You know, no matter what anybody says, this is still the old South.
Anybody in particular who got upset? I asked.
Well, the Jackson boys. They're always in one sort of trouble or another, she said, and she was still watching the door. They just don't like colored people. So for him to be sporting something pretty, young, and white, he tended to do that a lot. Well, there's been talk. I'll just put it like that.
I was imagining Ku Klux Klansmen with burning crosses and white supremacists with cold eyes and guns. I had seen hate before. I had dipped my hands in its carnage for most of my life. My chest was tight as I bid Helen, the clerk, good night. I was trying not to leap to assumptions about prejudice and arson and an intended victim, which may have been only Sparks and not a woman whose body was now on its way to Richmond. Of course, it may simply have been Sparks' vast property that the perpetrators had been interested in, and they did not know anyone was home. The man in the tank top was on the payphone when I went out. He was absently holding his new light bulb and talking in an intense, low voice. As I walked past, his anger flared.
"Damn it, Louise, that's what I mean! You never shut up!"
he snarled into the phone, as I decided to call Benton later. I unlocked the red door to room 15, and Lucy pretended that she hadn't been waiting for me as she sat in a wing chair, bent over a spiral notebook, making notes and calculations. But she had not touched her fast food dinner, and I knew she was starved. I took Whoppers and French fries out of the bag and set paper napkins and food on a nearby table.
"Everything's cold," I simply said.
"You get used to it." Her voice was distant and distracted.
"Would you like to shower first?" I politely asked.
"Go ahead," she replied, buried in math, a scowl furrowing her brow. Our room was impressively clean for the price, and decorated in shades of brown, with a Zenith TV almost as old as my niece. There were Chinese lamps and long-tasseled lanterns, porcelain figurines, static oil paintings, and flower-printed spreads. Carpeting was a thick shag Indian design, and wallpaper was woodland scenes. Furniture was formica or so thickly shellacked that I could not see the grain of the wood. I inspected the bath and found it a solid pink and white tile that probably went back to the 50s, with styrofoam cups and tiny wrapped bars of Lisa luxury soap on the sink. But it was a single plastic red rose in a window that touched me most. Someone had done the best with the least to make strangers feel special, and I doubted that most patrons noticed or cared. Maybe 40 years ago such resourcefulness and attention to detail would have mattered, when people were more civilized than they seem to be now. I lowered the toilet lid and sat to remove my dirty wet boots. Then I fought with buttons and hooks, until my clothes retreated to a wilted heap on the floor. I showered until I was warm and cleansed of the smell of fire and death. Lucy was working on her laptop when I emerged in an old Medical College of Virginia t-shirt and popped open a beer. "What's up?" I asked as I sat on the couch.
"Just screwing around. I don't know enough to do much more than that," she replied.
"But that was a big fucking fire, Aunt Kay, and it doesn't appear to have been set with gasoline."
I had nothing to say.
"And someone died in it? In the master bathroom? Maybe. How did that happen? At 8 o'clock at night?"
"I did not know.
I mean, she's in there brushing her teeth, and the fire horn goes off?" Lucy stared hard at me.
"And what?" she asked.
"She just stays there and dies?"
She paused to stretch sore shoulders.
"You tell me, Chief. You're the expert."
"I can offer no explanation, Lucy," I said.
"And there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. World-famous expert Dr. K. Scarpetta doesn't know."
She was getting irritable.
19 horses," she went on. "So who took care of them? Sparks doesn't have a stable hand. And why did one of the horses get away? The little black stallion."
"How do you know it's a boy?" I asked, as someone knocked on our door.
"Who is it?" I asked through wood.
"Yo, it's me," Marino gruffly announced.
I let him in and could tell by the expression on his face that he had news.
"Kenneth Sparks is alive and well," he announced.
"Where is he?" I was very confused again.
"Apparently he's been out of the country and flew back when he heard the news. He's staying in Beaverdam and don't seem to have a clue about anything, including who the victim is," Marino told us.
"Why Beaverdam?" I asked, calculating how long the trip would take to that remote part of Hanover County.
"His trainer lives there."
"His?"
"Horse trainer. Not his trainer, like in weightlifting or nothing."
"I see."
"I'm heading out in the morning around 9 a.m., he said to me. "You can go on to Richmond or go with me."
"I have a body to identify, so I need to talk to him whether he claims to know anything or not."
"I guess I'm going with you," I said as Lucy met my eyes.
"Are you planning on our fearless pilot dropping us off, or have you managed to get a car?"
"I'm skipping the whirlybird," Marino retorted. "And do I need to remind you that the last time you had a chat with Sparks, you pissed him off?"
"I don't remember," I said. And I really did not, for I had irritated Sparks on more than one occasion when we disagreed about case details he thought should be released to the media.
"I can guarantee he does, Doc. You gonna share the beer or what?"
"I can't believe you don't have your own stash," Lucy said, as she resumed working on her laptop, keys clicking. He went to the refrigerator and helped himself to one.
"You want my opinion at the end of the day?" he said. "It's the same as it was."
"Which is?" Lucy asked without looking up.
"Sparks is behind this."
He set the bottle opener on the coffee table and stopped at the door, resting his hand on the knob.
"For one thing, it's just too friggin' convenient that he was suddenly out of the country when it happened," he talked on as he yawned. "So he gets someone to do his dirty work.
Money."
He slid a cigarette out of the pack in his shirt pocket and shoved it between his lips.
"That's all the bastards ever cared about, anyway. Money and his dick."
"Marino, for God's sake," I complained. I wanted to shut him up, and I wanted him to leave, but he ignored my cue.
"The worst news of all is now we probably got a homicide on our hands on top of everything else," he said as he opened the door. "Meaning yours truly here is stuck on this case like a fly on a pest strip. And that goes for the two of you. Shit."
He got out his lighter, the cigarette moving with his lips.
"The last thing I feel like doing right now. You know how many people that asshole's probably got in his pocket?"
Marino would not stop.
"Judges, sheriffs,
fire marshals. Marino, I interrupted him, because he was making everything worse. You're jumping to conclusions. In fact, you're jumping to Mars. He pointed his unlit cigarette at me.
Just wait, he said, as on his way out. Everywhere you turn on this one, you're going to run into a briar patch.
I'm used to it, I said.
You just think you are.
He shut the door too hard. Hey, don't wreck the joint, Lucy called out after him. Are you going to work on that laptop all night? I asked her.
Not all night. It's getting late, and there's something you and I need to discuss, I said,
and Carrie Grethen was back in my mind. What if I told you I don't feel like it? Lucy wasn't kidding. It wouldn't matter, I replied. We have to talk. You know, Aunt Kay, if you're going to start in on Tian and Philly... What? I said, baffled. What does Tian have to do with anything? I can tell you don't like her.
That's utterly ridiculous.
I can see through you, she went on. I have nothing against Tian, and she is not relevant to this conversation. My niece got silent. She began taking off her boots. Lucy, I got a letter from Carrie. I waited to see a response and was rewarded with none. It's a bizarre note, threatening, harassing, from Kirby Forensic Psychiatric Center in New York. I paused again as Lucy dropped a boot to the shag carpeting. She's basically making sure we know that she intends to cause a lot of trouble during her trial, I explained. Not that this should come as any great surprise, but, well, I stumbled as she tugged off wet socks and massaged her pale feet. We just need to be prepared, that's all. Lucy unbuckled her belt and unzipped her pants as if she had not heard a word I'd said. She pulled her filthy shirt over her head and threw it on the floor, stripping down to sports bra and cotton panties. She stalked toward the bathroom, her body beautiful and fluid, and I sat staring after her, stunned, until I heard water run. It was as if I had never really noticed her full lips and breasts, and her arms and legs curved and strong like a hunter's bow. Or maybe I simply had refused to see her as someone apart from me and sexual, because I chose not to understand her or the way she lived. I felt shamed and confused when, for an electric instant, I envisioned her as Carrie's supple, hungry lover. It did not seem so foreign that a woman would want to touch my niece. Lucy took her time in the shower, and I knew this was deliberate because of the discussion we were about to have. She was thinking. I suspected she was furious. I anticipated she would vent her rage on me. But when she emerged a little later, she was wearing a Philadelphia Fire Marshal T-shirt that did nothing but darken my mood. She was cool and smelled like lemons. Not that it's any of my business, I said, staring at the logo on her chest. Tian gave it to me, she answered. Ah, and you're right, Aunt Kay. It's none of your business. I just wonder why you don't learn, I started in as my own temper flared. Learn? She feigned a clueless expression that was meant to irritate, eliminate, and make one feel vapid. About sleeping with people you work with. My emotions hurled down their own treacherous track. I was being unfair, jumping to conclusions with little evidence, but I was scared for Lucy in every way imaginable. Someone gives me a T-shirt, and suddenly I'm sleeping with this person? Quite a deduction, Dr. Scarpetta, Lucy said with gathering fury. And by the way, you're one to talk about sleeping with people you work with. Look who you practically live with. Hello! I was certain Lucy would have stormed out into the night if she had been dressed. Instead, she stood with her back to me, staring at a curtained window. She wiped outraged tears from her face as I tried to salvage what was left of a moment that I had never intended to turn out like this.
We're both tired,
I softly said.
It's been an awful day, and now Carrie has gotten just what she wanted. She has turned us on each other.
My niece did not move or utter a sound as she wiped her face again, her back solidly to me like a wall.
I am not at all implying that you are sleeping with Tien, I went on. I'm only warning you of the heartbreak and chaos. Well, I can see how it could happen.
She turned around and stared at me with a challenge in her eyes.
What do you mean, you can see how it could happen? She demanded to know. She's gay? I don't remember her telling me that. Maybe things aren't so good with Janet right now, I went on. And people are people.
She sat on the foot of my bed, and it was clear she intended to hold me to this conversation.
Meaning? She asked.
Just that. I wasn't born in a cave. Tien's gender makes no difference to me. I do not know a thing about her proclivities. But if you are attracted to each other, why wouldn't anyone be attracted to either of you? Both of you are striking and compelling and brilliant and heroic. I'm just reminding you that she's your supervisor, Lucy.
My blood pounded as my voice got more intense.
And then what? I asked. Will you move from one federal agency to another until you've screwed yourself out of a career? That's my point, like it or not. And that's the last I will ever bring it up.
My niece just stared at me as her eyes filled again. She did not wipe them this time, and tears rolled down her face and splashed the shirt Tien McGovern had given to her.
I'm sorry, Lucy, I gently said. I know your life isn't easy.
We were silent as she looked away and wept. She took a deep, long breath that trembled in her chest.
Have you ever loved a woman? She asked me.
I love you.
You know what I mean.
Not in love with one, I said. Not to my knowledge.
That's rather evasive.
I didn't mean it to be.
Could you?
Could I what?
Love a woman, she persisted.
I don't know. I'm beginning to think I don't know anything.
I was as honest as I knew how to be.
Probably that part of my brain is shut.
It has nothing to do with your brain.
I wasn't sure what to say.
I've slept with two men, she said. So I know the difference for your information.
Lucy, you don't need to plead your case to me.
My personal life should not be a case.
But it's about to become one. I went back to that subject. What do you think will be Carrie's next move?
Lucy opened another beer and glanced to see that I still had plenty.
Send letters to the media? I speculated for her. Lie under oath? Take the stand and go into gory detail about everything the two of you ever said and did and dreamed?
How the hell can I know? Lucy retorted.
She's had 5 years to do nothing but think and scheme, while the rest of us have been rather busy.
What else might she know that could come out?
I had to ask. Lucy got up and began to pace.
You trusted her once, I went on. You confided in her, and all the while she was an accomplice to Galt. You were their pipeline, Lucy, right into the heart of all of us.
I'm really too tired to talk about this, she said.
But she was going to talk about it. I was determined about that. I got up and turned off the overhead light, because I had always found it easier to talk in an atmosphere soft and full of shadows. Then I plumped pillows on her bed and mine and turned down the spreads. At first she did not take me up on my invitation, and she paced some more like some wild thing as I silently watched. Then she reluctantly sat on her bed and settled back.
Let's talk about something besides your reputation for a moment, I began in a calm voice. Let's talk about what this New York trial is all about.
I know what it's all about.
I was going to give her an opening argument anyway, and raised my hand to make her listen. Temple Galt killed at least 5 people in Virginia, I began,
and we know Carrie was involved in at least one of these, since we have her on videotape pumping a bullet into the man's head. You remember that. She was silent. You were in the room when we watched that horrific footage right there in gory color on TV, I went on. I know all this. Anger was crawling into Lucy's voice again. We've been over it a million times, she said. You watched her kill, I went on. This woman who was your lover when you were all of 19 and naive and doing an internship at ERF, programming Kane. I saw her draw up more into herself as my monologue became more painful. ERF was the FBI's engineering research facility, which housed its criminal artificial intelligence network computer system, known as Kane. Lucy had conceived Kane and been the driving force behind its creation. Now she was locked out of it and could not bear to hear its name. You watched your lover kill after she had set you up in her cold-blooded, premeditated way. You were no match for her, I said. Why are you doing this? Lucy's voice was muffled, her face resting on her arm. A reality check. I don't need one. I think you do. And by the way, we won't even go into the personal details both Carrie and Gault learned about me. And this brings us to New York, where Gault murdered his own sister and at least one police officer, and now forensic evidence shows that he didn't do it alone. Carrie's fingerprints were later recovered on some of Jane Gault's personal effects. When she was captured in the Bowery, Jane's blood was found on Carrie's pants. For all we know, Carrie pulled that trigger, too. She probably did, Lucy said. And I already know about that. But not about Eddie Heath. Remember the candy bar and can of soup he bought at the 7-Eleven? The bag found with his dying, mutilated body? Carrie's thumbprint since has been recovered. No way! Lucy was shocked. There's more. Why haven't you told me this before? She was doing this all along with him, and probably helped him break out of prison back then, too. We have no doubt. They were Bonnie and Clyde long before you met her, Lucy. She was killing when you were 17 and had never been kissed. You don't know that I'd never been kissed, my niece inanely said. No one spoke for a moment. Then Lucy said, and her voice quavered, So, you think she spent 2 years plotting a way to meet me and become... and do the things she did to seduce you? I cut in. I don't know if she planned it that far in advance. Frankly, I don't care. My outrage mounted. We've moved heaven and earth to extradite her to Virginia for those crimes, and we can't. New York won't let her go. My beer bottle was limp and forgotten in my hands as I shut my eyes, and flashes of the dead played through my mind. I saw Eddie Heath propped up against a dumpster as rain diluted the blood from his wounds, and the sheriff and prison guard killed by Gault and probably Carrie. I had touched their bodies and translated their pain into diagrams and autopsy protocols and dental charts. I could not help it. I wanted Carrie to die for what she had done to them, to my niece and me. "She's a monster," I said, as my voice shook with grief and fury. I will do anything I can to make sure she is punished. Why are you preaching all this to me? Lucy said in a louder, upset voice. Do you somehow think I don't want the same thing? I'm sure you do. Just let me throw the switch or stick the needle in her arm. Don't let your former relationship distract you from justice, Lucy. Jesus Christ. It's already an overwhelming struggle for you. And if you lose perspective, Carrie will have her way. Jesus Christ, Lucy said again. I don't want to hear any more. You wonder what she wants? I would not stop. I can tell you exactly. To manipulate the thing she does best. And then what? She'll be found not guilty by reason of insanity, and the judge will send her back to Kirby. Then she'll suddenly and dramatically improve, and the Kirby doctors will decide she's not insane. Double jeopardy. She can't be tried twice for the same crime. She ends up back on the street.
If she walks, Lucy coldly said, I will find her and blow her brains out.
What kind of answer is that? I watched her silhouette sitting straight up against pillows on her bed. She was very stiff, and I could hear her breathing as hatred pounded inside her. The world really won't care who or what you slept or sleep with unless you do, I said to her more quietly.
This book is continued on Disc 3.